Case number 21-3979, United States versus Kenneth Johnson, and case number 21-4013, United States versus Garnell Jamison. Argument not to exceed 20 minutes shared by appellants and 20 minutes for appellee. Mr. Watson, you may proceed for Mr. Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Byron Watson, representing the appellant, along with Gina Kuhlman, who's also seated at the table. We respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The appellant in this case, Ken Johnson, was a councilman. He was found guilty of federal program theft, fraudulent tax returns, obstruction, and improperly influencing a grand jury witness.
What's the most egregious error here on the part of the government, would you say?
We would say that the 404B evidence coming into the case was probably, I think, pretty significant in our judgment. We believe that the accusation or the insinuation of campaign finance fraud was not related to the issues in this case. And not only that, which made it more egregious, was that after the judge had instructed the jury not to consider it, again, the government's attorney in closing argument rebuttal went along that line to continue to accuse Mr. Johnson of campaign fraud.
What is the indication, or I guess I'm struggling a little bit with what the prejudice was. What's the argument about what the impact was, or how we can tell whether there was an impact or not?
I believe the impact is particularly with the politicians, and Mr. Johnson being in a position as being a politician, that all the things that go along with the politicians because of the media. That highlights, you know, misuse of monies for personal lifestyle or handling money in an appropriate way, particularly public money. In this instance, the government wanted to highlight that instead of money being donated to Buckeye, which is the nonprofit organization in which was doing a lot of the community service related stuff regarding helping homeowners with their properties, help rehabbing them, helping with regard to lawn care and the like, and I think that became some of the issues in the case. But that aside, we just believe that the prejudice that is typically associated with politicians, the government's attorney, I thought, went over the line in terms of trying to establish that, hey, you're dealing with a corrupt politician. Here's $31,000 that he didn't account for in his campaign accounts. This is indicative of how he does business, even though this particular highlight of that criminal act didn't have anything relating to the actual charges that was facing Mr. Johnson.
Of course, the district judge did instruct the jury not to take any of this as evidence of campaign finance violations, didn't he?
Yes, the court absolutely did that, and as the reward in that is that the government's attorney went back in that same area during rebuttal close, and my objection was overruled regarding that particular misstep by the government. So you have a mixed message given to the jury saying, well, I guess it's okay for us to consider that. And so I think that in that instance, that denied Mr. Johnson a fair trial in that. I think that just below that particular argument, we believe that the improper impeachment of a character witness in the case was particularly egregious as well. That witness, Sam Gissentainer, who worked for the city, who was a government witness, by the way, indicated that he talked about what happened regarding the recreation center that was named after Mr. Johnson. The government's attorney, during redirect examination, posed questions to this witness, assuming Mr. Johnson's guilt. And in that sense, we believe that that was egregious because it undercut the presumption of innocence in this case, because the government's attorney was essentially telling the character, well, this particular witness, who was a government witness.
What was he called for by the government?
The government was established that Mr. Johnson did not abide by the donation procedures related to the recreation center. When certain items were donated to the center, it had to be documented, particularly if it was over a certain dollar amount.
And then who brought up his knowledge of the character of your client? Was that done by defense counsel?
It was done by defense counsel.
The defense counsel used him as their own witness, right?
That's right.
Okay, and then the government came back with rebuttal questions.
Right.
Right, okay.
And in that sense, there's nothing wrong with that, Judge Seiler, okay. In terms of the government when that issue is raised as to a person's reputation in the community. But I think what the government did in this case, which stepped over the line here, was that asking or establishing that certain allegations within the case itself had already been proven to be true. And that was the big problem here, because in addition to that, the government stating that, the government has a certain level of prestige that most people would jurors would take and say, hey, the government said it, it must be true, that the government's attorney has taken a particular position that these facts had already been established. But what happened in addition to that is the court made the comment during this correcting instruction that the state of the evidence was that allowed the government to ask those questions, which puts in a juror's mind and said, well, these particular facts or allegations had already been proven.
Remind me again, because I can't remember, what was there an objection at that point to what the court had said, or was there a sidebar? What happened?
We did object initially regarding that, and when the judge made the instruction, we immediately filed a motion for a mistrial during the trial, and then the judge, by journal entry, denied our motion for mistrial during the trial phase.
Because of both the government's kind of implication that this stuff had been proven, yes, or whatever, and the judge's seeming approval or whatever of that. Is that right? That was the grounds for the mistrial. The grounds, okay.
And so
you have a good case that you're depending upon to show that was all wrong.
I believe that the one of the government's cases in the McGuire case, actually, when it cites that other cases from other circuits, particularly United States versus Pasanelli, in which the Sixth Circuit has already adopted and said that it was inappropriate for a character witness to assume a defendant's guilt. And I think that case falls on all fours here, because the government's attorney stated, if you knew that Ken Johnson had used his child's accounts inappropriately and without their consent and permission. So there was a whole litany of questions where the guilt of Mr. Johnson was presumed. Now, the government has indicated in its response brief that this was kind of within acceptable grounds, but usually when you're talking about character evidence, what is the person's reputation in the community, whether or not they heard certain things in the community. These particular allegations had not even been proven in this case, and it was inappropriate for the government, we believe, to go along that line of questioning. Now, if he asked, had you heard anything about these allegations in the media or from friends or people in the community, then it would have been proper. But for the government to come in and directly say that these particular things Mr. Johnson had in fact already done, would that change your opinion? And I believe that was the problem.
Thank you. I'm sorry, did you reserve rebuttal? You did, right? 3 minutes?
Yes, three minutes.
Okay, we'll hear from you in rebuttal. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am David Doughton, counsel for the co-defendant at trial, Garnell Jamison. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
This morning, in my time, I would like to address the sufficiency of the intimidation of a witness, and if time, whether the enhancement of the position of trust applies to Mr. Jamison as he was the assistant to Mr. Johnson. But starting with the tampering with a witness, the allegation is, of course, that they somehow persuaded Elijah Johnson to provide false evidence to the grand jury. But in order to meet the statute, this has to have been done with intimidation, corruption, clearly with the intent to change his testimony.
He came to them and said he didn't have any proof, and so they told him how to doctor up some documents to show he did have proof.
Right? Well, I don't think that's it. I disagree with that. I thought the evidence was that the reason that Elijah came to Garnell was he was aware Garnell had kept his own records over a period of time. Mr. Jamison, in fact, had been keeping records. Now, they may have been false records. In fact, he was charged. Mr. Jamison was charged and convicted of presenting false testimony. So he was convicted of these false records. The issue is
the son worked up a new set of documents, right, before he testified. Was that what happened?
The son may have done that, but it was there was. It was difficult because Elijah kind of waffled. You know, he clearly, the government in his cross-examination felt, and with good reason, that he was kind of protecting his father. But if they, the point that we're making is if he did so because he would have done anyway. You know, if you have a let me give you an example to explain the difference between presenting false evidence and intimidation. If Elijah wanted to help his dad, and he just took records that were already prepared and presented them, having recklessly disregarding whether they're accurate or not, there was no influence going on there. There was no intimidation going on there. You know, and so the difference between whether you're presenting false records to the grand jury, which Mr. Jamison was convicted of and not appealing here, and intimidated a witness to present those same documents are two different facts or two different charges. So in this case, Elijah testified that, you know, he had been sick, he had been ill, he hadn't been doing what he was supposed to do, and he was aware that Mr. Jamison had kept records. In fact, he even said the notebooks that were provided to him, he went through and he was able to see a lot of the things in Mr. Jamison's notebooks he'd seen himself. You know, so, when, you know, that he had in there, for instance, that, you know, there were certain deductions or certain costs for things that were in the kitchen, and he'd seen those things. So, you know, he decided, fine, I'll just pass them on. So, you know, so the question is not whether there were false records presented. There were, and he was convicted of. It's whether they had, again, influenced by intimidation or somehow, you know, hey, you know, if you don't do this, you know, I'm going to go to jail. In fact, he said he wasn't told what to say. Elijah testified.
Are you saying there has to be, like, an explicit threat?
Well, it can be implicit. It can be implicit, you know, but the evidence has got to show that, you know, that there's, it has to have, the purpose of the statute is in essence to prevent someone from not cooperating or from changing their testimony or withholding part of their testimony, you know, because you want to have.
From the witness's perspective, or is it the intent of the defendant?
I think it's the intent of the defendant. You know, because if you know, for instance, Mr. Jamison or Mr. Johnson came and said, here's my records.
Can I ask you to address, sure. I know your time's running short, can you address the enhancement issue?
Yes. The issue here is the position itself is what causes the trust to evolve. If you're in a position that the title itself.
I mean, we've said, let's cut to the chase, in the White case we said that you can basically have a position of trust with regard to, like, the general public.
Yes.
Okay. That case involved government agencies that you weren't necessarily in a position of trust with but the general public is also relevant to this inquiry. Why didn't your client have enough discretion to make loans and do all this stuff that it would count under that line of cases?
My time's up. May I have time to?
Yeah, yeah.
It can cut into my rebuttal, obviously, because anything that Mr. Jamieson did was because of had to be approved by Mr. Johnson. He himself was not in a position. He was the assistant. None of the loans were obtained by Mr. Jamieson because of his position. It was his association of Mr. Johnson's position that did it. And so it's basically, you can't aid and abet for a position of trust because that's essentially what's going on here. So that, you know, none of the public funds were given to Mr. Jamieson. They were given, he wasn't the one that applied for it. He wasn't the one who obtained it. Even the lending and stuff, it was all with the authority which people went along with Mr. Jamieson because of his association with Mr. Johnson.
Jamieson testified to this?
No, he did not.
So we don't know. On the record?
On the record, yes, that's correct. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. You'll have your full rebuttal time. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you. May it please the court, Matt Call for the government. The defendants have not demonstrated any error at trial or at sentencing, and therefore we ask the court to affirm the convictions and sentence. I'd like to cover three points today. First, the district court committed no errors in its evidentiary rulings that defendant Johnson challenges. Second, there was sufficient evidence to convict defendant Jamieson of both schemes with which he was convicted. And finally, that the district court properly calculated the guidelines. Diving into the first issue that Mr. Watson cites regarding what he describes as Rule 404B evidence, it wasn't Rule 404B evidence. It was rebuttal evidence specifically asked to address an issue that Councilman Johnson had testified to during his own direct examination when he took the stand. By way of background, one of the allegations against Councilman Johnson was that he had improperly claimed a $31,000 tax deduction purportedly for a donation to the to Buckeye, to the Development Corporation.
Was this from the campaign funds or was this from the cars?
Well, this is relating to the campaign funds, Your Honor. And in our case in chief, we introduced various bank records to show there was no evidence that this $31,000 donation was either a donation or had come from Councilman Johnson. Rather, the evidence showed it was a loan and it came from Garnell Jamieson. That was the state of the evidence in the government's case in chief, and the word campaign was never mentioned. When Councilman Johnson took the stand, and he was asked about that during Mr. Watson's direct examination, he said, that came from campaign funds. Well, we had the campaign records, and they showed no such donation. And that's why we properly inquired on cross-examination about that. It wasn't alleging any kind of campaign fraud violation. It was specifically to address an element of the tax offense with which he was charged, and frankly, to impeach his credibility, which is always at issue when an individual takes the stand.
Were these campaign funds in a bank account, or are they just kind of loosely kept in the office?
We introduced the campaign bank account records, and we asked Mr. Johnson to show where in there it came from, and there was no such evidence of it. We never alleged, and if you look at the...
You all requested an instruction, though, right? Some kind of limiting instruction, is that right?
We did, in an abundance of caution, we did, Your Honor.
And what was the purpose of, like, you were clearly worried about something or out of an abundance of caution, so what?
We did not want the jury to get the impression that we thought this was a campaign finance violation, which is what Mr. Watson alleged. So in an abundance of caution to protect the record and to ensure we weren't stepping over the line, we did request that limiting instruction, and it was given without objection. So
claims in rebuttal argument, you brought it up again.
The rebuttal argument properly argued the relevance of the evidence, just as I described it, that there was no evidence from the campaign records that the donation was ever made. We never alleged, implied, inferred in any way, shape, or form that he had somehow committed some sort of new additional wrong relating to his campaign. In fact, our position was that donation was never made by Councilman Johnson, not from cash, not from his personal records, not from his campaign records, and therefore he had lied on his taxes, with which is what he was charged with. So it went directly to an element of the offense, and it went to impeach his credibility, because Councilman Johnson, on his direct examination, raised the issue of campaign funds, not the government. So we don't believe that was Rule 404B evidence at all. The evidence showed that Buckeye booked this on its books as a loan from Garnell Jameson, issued Garnell Jameson a receipt for it, so it was intended to address an element of that specific offense. Turning to the questions relating to character evidence, again, this was something that Councilman Johnson placed at issue. During his cross-examination of the witness Samuel Gisson Tanner, he asked questions regarding his reputation for honesty and truthfulness and the like, which is proper. But when he does that, which he's permitted to do under Rule 404A2, Rule 405A then says that the government is permitted to rebut that testimony with, quote, specific instances of the person's conduct. And that's what happened here. They asked a handful of questions, I believe it was four or five questions relating to specific instances of conduct, and the witness's answers on that conduct.
Well, his argument is that you can't use specific instances that are at issue in the case that haven't been proven yet.
And there are cases that say that, Your Honor, but I think if you look at the specific language of the questions asked in that case, that wasn't done. They were asked in the conditional, if this were the case. And then in the court's limiting instruction, it said the government was asking about allegations.
What's your best case on that?
I believe the Frost case from this court, Your Honor. In the Frost case, this court said that the government, once a defendant has opened the door regarding such character evidence, can ask about conduct and even about charges that may have come to the attention of the relevant community.
But if you open the door, are you allowed to do more than you would have been able to do just calling them as a character witness, I guess?
I think so. I'm not sure I understand your question, but I think the answer is yes.
I guess I'm just saying, are you in a better position because they brought it up in cross-examination of your witness than you would have been had, I suppose, they brought it up? If they had called were you in the same position as if they had called the person on direct and used them as a character witness?
I believe it's the same position, Your Honor.
Okay, okay.
I'm not saying we get extra latitude merely because it was on cross-examination.
What about the judge's comment about the state of the evidence? The state of the evidence as it's been presented, I take it as your argument that he wasn't saying the state of the evidence showing this, but I don't know. How do you interpret that?
Well, and the court, in its limiting instructions, specifically said that the government was asking about allegations. So I think you have to take that into account. And at the end of the case, in its closing instructions, the court said, you know, my opinions don't matter, and it's up to you to make the decision on it, as we do in all cases. So I think it's a stretch to say that the court was somehow instructing the jury that these specific allegations had been proven. When he uses the word allegations, the government's permitted to ask him because they are allegations in this case. So I think that it overstates the case to say that the court somehow instructed the jury that these facts were found, or that the government's questions somehow implied that these specific facts were found. And frankly, even if the questions had been improper, the defendant hasn't demonstrated any harm from them. It's well established that questions are not evidence, and the jury was so instructed at 4143 to 44. The witness's answers to those questions was relatively benign. His answers were some version of, I would have to scrutinize that. That really boiled down to it as a fancy way of saying, I don't know if it would affect my opinion. And so to say that
But that's interesting, because I don't think the problem was what the answers were from the witness. The problem is if the jury is getting the impression that the court thinks this is a done deal, why are we here? Why are we going through the motions? He's already commented the evidence is good. The government's asking about these allegations as if they've already been proven. I guess I only have one choice here, right?
But I disagree with your interpretation of that, because the questions were, if you learned that, would it affect? It was conditional. It was put in the, I believe it's the subjunctive.
No, I understand so, that. And that would go to whether there was an error or not. But if the error is as they have characterized it, then I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't be prejudicial at that point.
But
you have to accept all the premise, and I'm not saying that you would, but I'm just saying that.
But accepting that premise, then we're into whether or not the error was harmless. And the burden for harmless error, was it more likely than not that it affected the outcome in this case under Rule 52? And the harm in this was that one witness said that he might have to look at it again. And there was overwhelming evidence of Councilman Johnson's guilt in this case, so much that he hasn't even challenged sufficiency on any count or any scheme in this case. The jury had already heard substantial evidence that's gone unchallenged. So to say that these, I believe it was four, maybe five questions, so inflamed or infected the jury, I think is just too far a stretch, given that he introduced substantial other character evidence throughout the case. And so we don't believe that if those questions were improper, that any harm resulted from it.
What about the Jameson argument?
As to Jameson, specifically as to the witness tampering issue, no threat is required. And that's one fundamental disagreement I have with my colleague, Mr. Doughton, when he told this court that some sort of threat is required for a 1512 B1 conviction. It's not. The elements are corruptly persuade. If it's shown that the defendant corruptly persuades a witness in an official proceeding with the intent to influence them, that is sufficient. So no threat is required. We didn't prove a threat, but we did prove that he tried to corruptly persuade them. Based on Elijah Johnson's evidence, the state of the evidence was that Elijah Johnson didn't know anything about any donations. He had no records about any donations. And when he was told, you're going to be subpoenaed to be a grand jury witness regarding these records, he went to Councilman Johnson, he went to Garnell Jameson, and they gave him records, and they met with him and reviewed them, knowing that he would be going into the grand jury. They were, in essence, trying to create false testimony that would be presented to an official grand jury in order to influence them.
What should he have done? Just say, I don't have any records?
Yes.
Go to the grand jury and say, I don't have them.
Yes, he should have said, I don't have any records. And if we had followed up with questions about what do you know about these donations, the correct answer would be, I don't know anything about this. You would have to ask other people because I don't know.
He could have taken the fifth, I guess.
If he had a fifth, sure, that would be another option. But I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He didn't do that.
He did not. He went to Garnell Jameson. Garnell Jameson gave him false records. That count is unchallenged on appeal. And then he met with him and reviewed those records with him a day or so before he testified in the grand jury. Simply encouraging witnesses to provide false testimony is sufficient to support a witness tampering charge under 1512 B1, as this court stated in the LeVictor case, which we cited in our brief. So we believe there was sufficient evidence to show Mr. Jameson's guilt on that count.
What about the enhancement of the sentence for breach of public trust?
Certainly, Your Honor. Mr. Jameson does challenge that, and we believe the evidence was sufficient to support that in this case. I'd note that it's a factual finding whether or not that occurred, according to this court in the Williams case, and therefore it's reviewed for clear error, giving due deference to the district court's finding. This district court sat through a week and a half long trial and heard all the evidence, and the record clearly showed that people regarded Mr. Jameson as Councilman Johnson's proxy or his stand-in. He acted with the longest-serving councilman in city history's full weight and authority. His accountant, Councilman Johnson's accountant, testified essentially she believed that he had power of attorney for him. So he acted with Councilman Johnson's full authority, and he abused that.
But he abused that, I mean, vis-a-vis Johnson. So he was Johnson's agent. So normally you would say the agent is in a position of trust with regard to the principal, but the principal is also a defendant in this case.
Yes.
So what abuse, what, whose trust was abused here? That's what I'm struggling with.
And I'm not sure, I think it's, I'm not sure we have to show whose position was abused, because even under the guidelines,
our cases suggest that you've got to, you know, the guidelines say it's like an attorney stealing money, a banker, whatever it is. We have that, we have the U.S. Bank, the Pavlovich, or whatever that case is. We have White. We've got the other cases. I'm sure you know them. In every case, we're talking about, you know, is it a government agency? Is it the public? Who is it? This case, I mean, we look, both people are criminal defendants here. I'm not sure. I mean, it seems odd to say. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think we do have to talk about whose trust was abused here. That's, I guess that's what I'm getting at.
He abused his position of authority, and he developed that position of authority by being Councilman Johnson's chief aide. And other people testified that they viewed him essentially as a stand-in for the councilman. So yes, he was using Councilman Johnson's position in order to do things, but the guidelines say that's okay if you read the application notes. I believe it's note 3 that says even a person with apparent authority can be on the hook for an abusive position of trust where they act with that authority.
Is there evidence that he acted independently sometimes without approval of Johnson? Or did he just take orders from Johnson? And
I think it fell somewhere in between, Your Honor. I don't think he was acting independently. I think that he and the councilman had ongoing conspiracies, and that he knew what the councilman was up to and acted with his authority to further those.
But he certainly was involved in a big way on those those evidence that went before the grand jury about the son, right?
He certainly was. And I think the best evidence relating to Mr. Jamison's abusive position of trust came from Mr. Fitzpatrick, who testified that he needed Johnson and Jamison's support for a pending promotion. And because of that pressure, that was one of the reasons he felt pressured into filling out those false timesheets as part of the $1,200 monthly scheme. And that's based on Mr. Fitzpatrick's testimony at 2468 to 69, 2516 to 17. And then the testimony from Mr. Hopkins, who ran Buckeye, was that Jamison negotiated large bonuses for himself and Johnson's children from Buckeye, even though the organization was in terrible financial condition. And that's page ID 2928 to 29. Buckeye needed Councilman Johnson's assistance. By the end of this, all of their funding was coming from block grant funds, and Councilman Johnson controlled the purse on that. So they were very much at his mercy and wanted to do anything they could to please him. And so when Garnell Jamison comes to them to negotiate bonuses, there's pressure. And so we believe that does indicate a use of a position of authority over another organization, and he did so
it's
to benefit himself.
So it's real. Did Johnson get the same enhancement?
I believe he did, Your Honor, and he does not challenge that on appeal.
So it's Johnson, it's really, he's stepping in, you're saying he's a proxy for Johnson, so he's basically, whatever Johnson's abuse of trust is, it's also Jamison?
I think that takes it a step too far, Your Honor, because Jamison went out and did things himself to benefit both himself and Johnson. So I think there's independent evidence that he was acting with Johnson's authority to further these schemes and to benefit himself.
But, okay, so then whose trust is he abusing at that point?
Right, taxpayers in the city. He had that position of trust by being the chief aide city council.
It's like White, so then we're basically back to White, where you're kind of the general public is counting on you to keep our water safe, and so it's not really the EPA or somebody that is counting on you, it's the general public, and that's enough.
I think it is enough, Your Honor, when you look at the position
about White, though.
I'm sorry.
Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, the one thing we say in White, as I recall, is for public safety and something else, public health and public safety. It's almost like, okay, the general public thing is a little bit different in those cases where it's a more traditional kind of scheme or whatever. I'm not sure that works.
I'd agree with that, but I go back to the text of the guideline, 3B1.3. If the person has substantial decision-making authority or discretion, I may be getting it slightly wrong, and that's what Councilman Johnson had vis-a-vis these block grant funds.
The way I read that is, somebody trusts me, some person that can't control their own affairs or whatever, they trust me, and one of the indications that I have this trust, of course, is that I have complete discretion to do things. So I am putting all my trust in you, and you get to go do and make your decisions. And what I'm saying is, who is putting their trust in Jameson? The obvious answer is Johnson is putting his trust in Jameson, but that's not what we're getting at here, right? So we're kind of like, okay, who's trusting this guy? Is it the general public that says, I trust Johnson, and therefore I also implicitly am trusting the people that he's further trusting? Is that, I mean, that seems like maybe the best theory that you've got, but I don't know.
It does, but I think it goes a step further in that if a person has substantial authority, which Councilman Johnson did, and which he delegated to Mr. Jameson, that in and of itself can be enough. And there's no debate that Councilman Johnson had substantial control over these funds. He had substantial say in who could get promoted. And Garnell Jameson went to Fitzpatrick regarding the promotion, and that was in Fitzpatrick's mind at the time. And he negotiated large bonuses for himself and the councilman's children. And so we believe he did use his position of trust. I see my time has expired. If there are no other questions, we'd ask the court to affirm the convictions and sentence.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, we believe that when the government says that there was no evidence that the $31,000 was in fact given, and that the government challenges that Johnson ever gave that money, the record indicates that, one, through his tax returns, he did make a claim deduction of that $31,000 that was given to Buckeye. I believe that Mr. Hopkins, who was the executive director as well, indicated, and it was in the government's witness that said that Councilman Johnson had in fact given the company $31,000 because they needed the money.
But that at that point, it's an issue that's in controversy, right? I mean, is the government allowed to say, look, we don't believe that this donation was made from you, it came from your campaign funds, which kind of puts the campaign funds issue out there, and they request a limiting instruction to kind of prevent what you're saying happened here. I get, why is that not enough?
Because the government then characterizes it in its closing argument as campaign funds. And Mr. Johnson had, in fact, during his examination, even though there was some ambiguity, but he cleared it up and said, hey, this was cash that I was saving for my campaign. Given that circumstances, I think for the government then to go back in, I think that caused prejudice.
I got a question on this abuse of public trust. There's a Seventh Circuit case called, I guess, FIFE.
I think that this is Johnson's counsel.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. You're right.
And so we believe that the prejudice is there, but with reference to the character evidence that was being argued by the government that it was harmless, I think the court has to take in consideration the judge's position in this case, because the way the jury is going to view what the judge says and what his state of impartiality is in the case, when the government asks questions that facts have already been proven, and then the court to come back and say, listen, what the government actually said and did was the appropriate thing, and the state of the evidence reflects that. And I think that's where the problem comes in.
I understand your argument. I'm not sure I read that statement the same. I mean, the state of the evidence is what's maybe in evidence, but it doesn't, I'm not sure, you're saying the judge is basically commenting and saying, this is a done deal, it's been proven, and I don't know if it goes that far.
The court is endorsing what the government said. And so when the government says that, you know, Mr. Johnson has already done these things, the court is endorsing what the government has said, and that's where the problem comes in this particular case.
With regarding the substantial evidence quotient, this, you know, Mr. Johnson's case is a little bit different. A lot of the case was based on whether or not what his knowledge was and what his intent was. And so when the government says, well, there was overwhelming evidence, and you should take into account that we didn't file, you know, challenges as to sufficiency, we believe that if believed, the, you know, the evidence believed could prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't mean the case by the government is substantial.
Okay. All right. We hear you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Your argument. We'll hear from counsel for Mr. Jameson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to follow up briefly on what Mr. Watson was saying. The standard for harmless is not whether there's otherwise sufficient evidence. It's whether that error contributed. The government has a burden beyond a reasonable doubt to show contribute. I cringe when I hear that. I apologize.
Sounds like Mr. Judge Gilman's got a question.
Yeah, I was just curious about, you know, there's a Seventh Circuit case that held that a special assistant to the mayor was subject to that enhancement. FIFE, United States v. Fife, a 2006 Seventh Circuit case. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
And how would you distinguish that?
Well, first of all, I think it's wrongly decided. The issue with the notes and guidelines is, does the position itself, is that what generates the trust and facilitates the ability to do the wrong? And so in this case, the position that facilitated the ability, the trust to get the grants, the loans, was Mr. Johnson's position. You know, not, now, do I agree with the government's position that they were involved in tax fraud? Yes, but they were charged and convicted of those offenses.
You're saying Mr. Jameson didn't do anything unless he was told by Johnson to do it?
He did have, I would agree with the government that he had considerable discretion, but there was, like, my reading of the record is, frankly, in a light most favorable to the government, was that they had a general plan, like he understood what Mr. Johnson wanted and how he facilitated it.
He knew about the fraud and he was just helping it out.
Well, you know, and in all fairness to the government, he sometimes, you know, was able to come up with the specific plan that was the general. So I don't want to.
Why under that theory is he not just basically like Johnson and whatever trust Johnson is abusing, Jameson is abusing?
Well, if that's the case, they're
basically just acting together to abuse public trust.
The guideline, frankly, would have said that, would have put out. So the problem with the Fife case is that anybody within, let's say, a politician's office who carried out, helped the politician, not that there's corrupt politicians, but assuming there was, helped them carry out whatever response would be, they would be guilty of the violation of position of trust. They're guilty of the offense. In this case, Jameson was convicted of various of frauds. But the issue is whether it's enhanced because of his position.
Well, in White we said we don't want to carry the public as victim too far because every public official would, or every public employee would get swept in, which I take it as your
yes
argument. But then I would say, well, Jameson's not necessarily like every public employee precisely because he has all of this discretion to kind of act and do things on his own and yes, with some direction, but that kind of sets him apart than the ministerial clerk who's just signing checks or doing whatever, even though they know that it's, you know, for bribes or something. So I don't know.
My brief response.
Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, sure. Town was, the difference is, the funds and loans were already obtained by Johnson, and I would point to Ragland where this court talked about the fiduciary duty the position has, and again we're in a position then where it becomes aiding and abetting the person who actually holds the position, and I don't think that's what the guidelines intended.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank both parties for the briefs and arguments, and the case will be submitted.